I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. Author Elena Passarello has created a bestiary with her new book of essays, Animals Strike Curious Poses, exploring the lives of individual animals who've had enough impact on humanity to be named and widely remembered. She'll celebrate the book's release with a reading as part of the Literary Northwest series at Oregon State University in Corvallis on Friday, February 24th, where she also teaches in OSU's School of Writing, Literature, and Film. Thanks for coming in, Elena.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, history as we know it is mostly a record of human events, yet animals are a key part of this world and therefore a part of true history. What made you decide to explore the animal side of history?
Honestly, the thing that made me start is not the thing that I ended up driving the book forward. In the beginning, and with all of my projects, I need some kind of a concept that I sense might keep me going. Something that I won't get bored with and something that will somehow inspire me enough to push through the tough times. I first started thinking about this book about 10 years ago. I found myself kind of relentlessly interested in fun animal facts, things about the biology of animals that are interesting, and I am a kind of a pop culture writer, places in which animals have taken a part in the popular human popular culture. That feels really sustaining to me, or felt really sustaining to me when I got started. But those fun animal facts often stand in front of some really complicated human-animal relationships. So I was really excited that, for example, a spider got shot up into space with the Skylab astronauts to spin a web with the men that were there in 1973. But the politics of animals in space is kind of interesting and difficult. And the way in which the spider overshadowed the work of the astronauts was kind of interesting and difficult. And that's kind of a nutshell of nearly every fun animal fact that got me into each essay in the book. I ended up having to kind of keep moving forward, thinking not so much about the animals as what happened with the humans and the animals at the time, and what that says about where we were as a nation, as a culture, as a region. You know, that what it's kind of mirroring back into what the humans were doing and thinking and things like that.
And how did you decide then, once you decided which animals would make the cut, how did you decide how to represent them with a specific literary voice? Because there are so many different voices in this book.
Well, the thing that was really exciting to me once the book got going is how different... So the rule for me when I got started, I always have to have a rule that keeps me from spazzing out and wanting to write about everything in the world. So you want to write a book about animals, you can't write about every animal. What about using the concept of a medieval bestiary where there's only one animal represented per chapter? That'll shut it down or narrow it down a little bit. And what if those animals had to have names that were somehow recorded into the historical human record? That'll make it even smaller. So I had those parameters there. And then I thought, well, then how can you make it look like a timeline of human thought? And then I got to sort of dive in every couple centuries or so and see if I could find an animal from within there. So once I set those three parameters for myself, I realized that I was looking at different sounds kind of humanity, right? The 1515 Northern Renaissance in Nuremberg, Germany, where I write about Dürer's rhino, the sort of famous viral woodcut that's completely biologically incorrect of this rhino that he never even saw. That sounds so different than the world of, 1600 London, where I write about a bear that it was a bear-baiting bear that performed these kind of grisly, no pun intended, acts right next to the Globe Theater. So when Hamlet was happening, this bear was happening, completely different sound. And then you compare that to the sound of, say, 1985 when Humphrey the humpback whale swam into the slough, you know, in Rio Vista off of or inland from San Francisco and sort of caught the TV and news crew world by storm because he was trapped. So I used literary styles or different approaches for all of these different things because the worlds in which these historical moments happened, they sounded so different. So that became just a really fun game when I would start a new section or realize that one animal was going to kind of make it to the finish line and then ask myself, I could do anything in the world with the way that this reads and sounds. What would what new flavor can I add in? This book, even more so than my first book, which was about sound and was about the human voice, really feels like an album to me, right? Like, this is my lovely Rita meter maid, and this is my octopus's garden. You know, I really think about, oh, what's the sitar version of the, like, of the literary thing that I can use here? And it's been so sustaining and fun to figure those things out as the book moves forward.
The one animal in this book that actually had human language was Coco the gorilla. So did you approach that chapter differently to get Coco's actual language correct?
Yes. So Coco is a strange story. Coco herself is a strange story, but my approach with Coco was very strange. When you make a book about animals, you end up kind of really having to dig deep looking for instances of joy, because a lot of these relationships are pretty sad or deal with cruelty. You have to sort of navigate a lot of really tricky territory. And I was convinced that the Coco story, I kind of put it off. I was like, oh, just wait till you get to Coco, like a vacation. Like, when you get to write about Coco, it's going to be this place of joy. Because when I was growing up, I'm of the age where Coco was a children's book for me. It was a National Geographic cover for me. The idea of this gorilla that had been taught sign language, that adopted a kitten that she then named, right? She's probably the only animal that has given a human moniker to another animal. I thought that this was going to be, you know, this perfect, joyous thing. And then, of course, you know, the more that I researched about Coco, the more I learned that it's seen as a much more complicated situation, right? Which I won't go into because it's complicated enough that I can't really come down on a side either way, whether or not Coco has had a good life or had a life that is kind of troubling. But once I finally got there and realized that I wasn't going to be able to write my happy Coco essay, I was so mad. I was so angry. Also, it kind of ruined my childhood, but that's another interview that we'll do. Then I was like, okay, what do you have? You have the 1,000-word lexicon of Coco, the sign language gorilla, purportedly. It's in the scientific record. A lot of different people have included it in their discussions of the Language Apes projects. Coco was one of many. And she's got a really interesting way of talking. She calls all women lips. And whenever she gets tired of talking to someone, she says drapes, because she closes the drapes when she goes to bed. So she says, if she's done with you, she's just like drapes. So there are these, she's got these vocabulary words and these language pairings. And those things are the closest thing to real that I can tell from this really difficult story. So I was having these really absurd feelings about Coco and angry feelings. And I only had this one thing to cling to that felt real. And so I thought, well, then all these people are putting words into Coco's mouth. So I'm going to put some words of my own into Coco's mouth. I'm going to use her words to express how absurd this situation feels to me now. And so now in the book, Coco, who's the only living animal in my book, actually, the only animal that's still alive, she tells the old vaudeville joke, The Aristocrats. Do you know this joke, Eric?
I do not.
Okay, well, it's completely not safe for radio, but it's this... kind of game that comedians play with each other after the comedy club shuts down. They sit backstage and they tell this joke. It has the same premise, but they can fill it in like a Shaggy Dog story, kind of however they want. And it's and then it's got this really kind of let down of a punchline, and it's just supposed to be as X-rated as possible. So I tried to use Coco's limited language to tell this. There's a great, by the way, documentary about this, The Aristocrats, that's done by Paul Provenza, in which all these different comedians tell the joke. Bob Saget, Sarah Silverman, a million different people. So I tried to make Coco kind of tell this terrible joke. Long story short. I don't know. I'm hoping that maybe there's none of Coco's people are listening right now, because they're probably going to come after me. But Coco loves dirty jokes. She's actually kind of known for her sense of humor. Like when she'll like play a prank on someone, and then she'll sign, and then her handler will say "bad gorilla," and then she'll sign back to them, "no, funny gorilla." So she loves jokes, and she loves scatological humor. So I feel like maybe I'll be okay.
Well, the title of this book is taken from a song by Prince. So how does Prince fit into this animalistic picture?
Well, I wanted to call the book this before we lost him. and honestly thought about changing it when we did. Prince is sort of, for me, a real cornerstone human. As an artist, as a thinker, as somebody who figured out a way to live his life as himself, I look to him a lot, and his music is just perfection to me. But I think the reason that I wanted to use this, I always want to use song titles as book titles. I did that with the first book, and I'm happy to do it with this one, and who knows what the next one will be. But in terms of Animal Strike Curious Poses, that song, When Doves Cry, came out when I was like 6. And it's the first song lyric that I really remember stopping me in my tracks and giving me something to imagine. So in some ways, the first time a work of art asked me to imagine an animal on my own terms is that line. I don't know if you remember the song, but he's just like, it's at the very first verse. He's like, imagine you and me kissing, and then we're in a courtyard full of flowers. And then all of a sudden there's animals striking curious poses because they feel the heat between Prince and his paramour. And in my 6, 7, 8-year-old mind, because that song was on the radio for most of my childhood, I just have this image of this kind of like Hieronymus Bosch, like lion just sort of there, like making this flat thing. And I think that's kind of what all of the essays in the book are about. This moment that an artist said something about a creature that is not human, and it's put some kind of thing in my mind that's stuck there, right? So that's why I think that title makes sense. And it's also from a song, When Doves Cry, that mentions another animal. So you get kind of a 1-2 punch. And speaking of Prince and doves, did you hear a Prince has had two doves, Divinity and Majesty, that lived in Paisley Park for like 26 years? And one of them just now died. Hmm. Majesty. So RIP Majesty. I hope you're up there singing with Prince.
The entire choir will inevitably be reunited over time.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's... Yeah, and I hope I get to see him too and dance.
Well, in medieval times, a bestiary was a collection of moralistic fables, basically. So are there morals to these stories or to the overall book?
The last long essay in the book is about the practice of de-extinction and what a complex and curious new road we're kind of sliding onto right now, the idea of using genetic technology to engineer species that are no longer with us, mm-hmm. often species whose demise is, we're responsible for their demise. And I guess for that one, the moral is, or not the moral, but the sort of moral thinking is we need to look deeper into what this means about us before we start making decisions. And there are a couple of essays in the book that maybe float into that direction. We need to look deeper into what we've done to understand what it means. Not why did we do this, we shouldn't have done this, but what does this say that we did this? What does it say that we have this relationship with animals? But I worked really hard, or I found the only way in which I could work when I was putting the book together was to come from my place as a human. And I am not... the kind of human who should necessarily be moralizing about the relationship between humans and animals, because I don't have a lot of interaction with them in my real life, honestly. I don't go outside that much, or, you know, I eat meat. I grew up with house pets that I didn't try to understand the way that some people do. My efforts at conservation are well-intended, but they are much more limited than some of my colleagues at Oregon State University, for example. I'm not an expert in the science of any of these creatures. What I am, and I am what I am, is a human who has grown up as a representative of a generation, a nationality, and a class that is completely saturated with animal stories. Nearly every article of clothing in my closet has some kind of put a bird on it, right, creature. I go on the internet every day and I see 8 emails that I have to answer, and I see, you know, a Yahoo clip that says catfish chokes on soccer ball, and I want to go and like watch that, or rhino and budgie are best friends. I listen to songs about animals and I send people GIFs of animals all the time. I live in this world that is saturated by the idea of animals, even though my reality with animals is questionable and complicated. I don't know what kind of moralizing you can do when you're working from that position, but I can certainly report from it and hopefully represent a kind of thinking that can be done even if you're not Jane Goodall.
And And what do you think we can gain then from listening to animals' voices in our own way in this wild world?
Well, I think it would be unsafe for me to say that I'm actually capturing any animals' voices in these books. These are voices of troubled humans and groups of humans that looked at animals at different times. And then hopefully the biology of animals that I learned from doing the research work for all of these pieces will push animals more into the center of the conversation, even though the voices are still human. I don't know, honestly, Eric, what it means to give animals a voice. I don't even know if it's possible to take away my voice or the voice of the people that are looking at animals. But I do think it helps to look, especially nowadays, at what has happened in history and to keep assessing it and then look where we are at now and see if that assessment moves us forward in more informed ways. So maybe in that respect, you know.
Has it changed your relationship to, say, house cats, to go through all of the writing process about animals?
Well, my relationship with house cats was completely changed in AP biology when we spent 6 weeks dissecting a cat right before lunch. And it was surprising. I thought that I was going to just go home and weep. You know, I grew up in a house of cats, but I actually kind of loved how much I knew about the way that my cats worked. So no, but I'll tell you what has changed. And this is, for me, the personal blessing of the book. I figured when I was going to write the book that I was just going to learn, I was going to learn so much about the charismatic megafauna and the crazy beasts that do things that no other beasts on earth do, you know, like those octopodes that can transform into any shape, you know, those really crazy things, that was going to be the new respect and fascination that I had. And that has not been the case at all. The two animals that I love and respect more than I ever have and ever will are these two species that live right outside my door here in Oregon. One is the cross spider, Araneus diadematis, and the other is the common starling, Sternus vulgaris. I have an essay in the book about the spider that went up on Skylab and spun a web in 1973. And where I grew up in Georgia, there were no cross spiders. But here in August and September, you walk outside of your house and they're everywhere. They're these really common creatures. And digging into the way that that web on Skylab was spun has completely affected the way that I feel when I see a cross spider on my window or when I'm walking to the bus and there's one. It's so awesome how much more present they are in my life now that I know so much about them. I bought a house in Corvallis because there was a nest of cross spiders in the eave of the back porch. Maybe my first tattoo will be a cross spider. And the same is the case with the starling, which has a much more kind of conflicted history in America. Do you know that the whole reason a starling is in America is because some dude wanted all of the birds from Shakespeare to show up in Central Park, and they came and they sort of took over the habitat and the food of a lot of native species, that some of which are not even with us anymore, and they just bred so well. But they're beautiful, and my essay on the starling is about this pet starling that Mozart had and would whistle compositions to. And so I learned a lot about the way starlings compose songs. And they have this four-part song structure, and they magpie phrases from humans and other birds and construction sites. And now if you're hanging around the streets of Corvallis or Eugene, or when I am at least, and you see a starling, you know, just sort of nesting on a light against a building, I can hear that four-part sound structure that has chainsaws and mockingbird sounds. And it's called whistle, warble, click, and screech, much like the four-part sonata form that Mozart used. And it's just... that's been the real joy of the book, is these, not the lions and tigers and octopuses and, you know, dodo birds, but these animals that I see every day, to have this greater understanding of the way that they're doing something spectacular every day in the world has been the major gift of the book for me.
Well, thank you for bringing us that gift through your words and through being here today.
Oh, thank you. It was such a pleasure. I love this place. I love you, Eric. Oh,
Elena Passarello, author of the new essay collection, Animals Strike Curious Poses. She'll read from it in a book release event at Oregon State University in Corvallis in the Valley Library Rotunda at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, February 24th, as part of the Literary Northwest series. For more information, oregonstate.edu and sarabandbooks.org. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.